Blog Talk Radio.
Shown me a strange image, and they are strange prisoners.
like ourselves, I replied, and they see only their own shadows, or the shadows of another one, with the which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave. True, he said. How could they see anything but the shadows if they were never allowed to move their heads? And of the objects which are being carried in like manner, they would only see the shadows. Yes, he said. And if they were able to converse with another, would they not suppose that they were naming what was actually before them? Very true. And suppose further that the prison had an echo which came from the other side, would they not be sure to fancy when one of the passers-by spoke that the voice which they heard came from the passing shadow? No question, he replied. To them, I said, the truth would be literally nothing but the shadows of the images. That is certain. And now look again and see what would naturally follow it. The prisoners are released and disabused of their error. At first, when any of them is liberated and compelled suddenly to stand up and turn its neck around and walk and look towards the light, he will suffer sharp pains. The glare will distress him, and he will be unable to see the realities of which in his former state he had seen the shadows, and then conceive some one saying to him that what he saw before was an illusion, but that now when he is approaching nearer to being and his eye is turned towards more real existence, he has a clearer vision. What will be his reply? And you may further imagine that his instructor is pointing to the objects as they pass and requiring him to name them. Will he not be perplexed? Will he not fancy that the shadows which he formerly saw are truer than the objects which are now shown to him? Far truer. And if he compelled to look straight at the light, will he not have a pain in his eye which will make him turn away to take in the objects of vision which he can see, and which he will conceive to be in reality clearer than the things which are now being shown to him? True. And suppose once more that he is reluctantly dragged up a steep and rugged ascent and held fast until he's forced into the presence of the sunlight himself, into the presence of the sun himself. Is he not likely to be pained and irritated? When he approaches the light, his eyes will be dazzled, and he will not be able to see anything at all of what are now called realities. He will require to grow accustomed to the sight of the upper world. And first he will see the shadows best, next the reflections of men and other objects in the water, and then the objects themselves. Then he will gaze upon the light of the moon and the stars and the spangled heaven, and he will see the sky and the stars by night better than the sun or the light of the sun by day. Last, he will be able to see the sun, and not mere reflections of him in the water, but he will see him in his own proper place and not in another, and yet will contemplate him as he is. And he will then proceed to argue that this is he who gives the season and the years and is the guardian of all that is in the visible world, and in a certain way the cause of all things which he and his fellows have been accustomed to behold. And when he remembered his old habitation and the wisdom of the den and his fellow prisoners, do you not suppose that he would facilitate himself on the change and pity them? Facilitate himself on the change. And if they were in the habit of conferring honors upon themselves, on those who were quickest to observe the past shadows and to remark which of them went before and which followed after, They which were together, and who were therefore best able to draw conclusions as to the future. Do you think that he would care for such honors and glories, or envy the possessors of them? Would he not say with Homer, better to be the poor servant of a poor master, and to endure anything, rather than think as they do and live after their manner? Yes, he said, I think that he would rather suffer anything than entertain these false notions and live in the miserable manner. Socrates replied, imagine once more, I said, such an one coming suddenly out of the sun to be replaced in his old situation. Would he not be certain to have his eyes full of darkness? And if there were a contest, and he had to compete in measuring the shadows with the prisoners who were never moved out of the den, while his sight was still weak, and before his eyes had become steady, and the time which would be needed to acquire this new habit of sight might be very considerable, would he not be ridiculous? Men would say of him that up he went and down he came without his eyes, and that he was better not even to think of ascending. And if anyone tried to lose another and lead him up to the light, let them only catch the offender, and they would put him to death. The entire allegory, I said, you may now append, dear Glaucon, to the previous argument. The prison house is the world of sight. The light of the fire is the sun. And you will not misapprehend me if you interpret the journey upwards to be the ascent of the soul into the intellectual world, according to my poor belief, which at your desire I have expressed, whether rightly or wrongly, God knows. But whether true or false, my opinion is that in the world of knowledge the idea of good appears last of all, and is seen only with an effort, and when seen, it is also inferred to be the universal author of all things beautiful and right, parent of light and the lord of light in this visible world, and the immediate source of reason and truth in the intellectual, and that this is the power upon which he who would act rationally, either in public or private life, must have his eye fixed. And Glaucon responds, I agree, he said, as far as I am able to understand you. Socrates says, moreover, I said, you must not wonder that those who attain to this beatific vision are unwilling to descend to human affairs, for their souls are ever hastening into the upper world, where they desire to dwell, which desire of theirs is very natural, if our allegory may be trusted. And is there anything surprising in one who passes from divine contemplations to the evil state of man, misbehaving himself in a ridiculous manner? If while his eyes are blinking, and before he has become accustomed to the surrounding darkness, he is compelled to fight in courts of law or in other places about the images or the shadows of images of justice, and is endeavoring to meet the conceptions of those who have never yet been absolute, who have never yet seen absolute justice. Anyone who has common sense will remember that the bewilderments of the eyes are of two kinds and arise from two causes, either from coming out of the light or from going into the light, which is true of the mind's eye, quite as much as of the bodily eye. And he who remembers this will, when he sees anyone whose vision is perplexed and weak, will not be too ready to laugh. He will first ask whether that soul of man has come out of the brighter light and is unable to see because accustomed to the dark, or having turned from darkness to the day, is dazzled by excess of light. And he will count the one happy in his condition and state of being, and he will pity the other, or he will have a mind to laugh at the soul which comes from below to the light. There will be more reason in this man in the laugh which greets him, who returns from above out of the light into the den. But then, if I am right, certain professors of education must be wrong when they say that they can put a knowledge into the soul which was not there before, like sight into blind eyes. They undoubtedly, whereas our argument shows that the power and capacity of learning exist in the soul already, and that just as the eyes are unable to turn from darkness to light without the whole body, so too the instrument of knowledge can only by the movement of the whole soul be turned from the world of becoming into that of being, and learned by degrees to endure the sight of being, and of the brightest and best of being, or in other words, of the good. And must there not be some art which will effect conversion in the easiest and quickest manner, not implanting the faculty of sight, for that exists already, but has been turned in the wrong direction and is looking away from the truth. And whereas the other so-called values of the soul seem to be akin to bodily qualities, or even when they are not originally innate, they can be implanted later by habit and exercise. The of wisdom, more than anything else, contains a divine element from which remains, and by this conversion is rendered useful and profitable, or, on the other hand, hurtful and useless. Did you never observe the narrow intelligence flashing from the keen eye of a clever rogue? How eager he is, how clearly his paltry soul sees the way of his end, and he is the reverse of blind. But his keen eyesight is forced into the source and the service of evil, and he is mischievous in proportions to his cleverness. But what if there had been a circumcision of such natures in the days of their youth, and they had been severed from those sensual pleasures, such as eating and drinking, which like leaden weights were attached to them at the birth, and which dragged them down and turned the vision of their souls upon the things that are below? If I say they had been released from these impediments and turned into the opposite direction, the very same faculty in them would have seen the truth as keenly as they see what their eyes are turned to now. Yes, I said, and there is another thing which is likely, or rather a necessary inference from what has preceded, that neither the uneducated and uninformed of the truth, nor yet those who never make an end of their education, will be able ministers of state. Not the former, because they have no single aim of duty, which is the rule of their actions, private as well as public. Not the latter, because they will not act at all except upon compulsion, fancying that they are already dwelling apart in the islands of the blessed. Then I said, the business of us who are the founders of the state will be to compel the best minds to attain that knowledge which we have already shown to be the greatest of all. They must continue to ascend until they arrive at the good. But when they have ascended and seen enough, we must not allow them to do as they now do. I mean that they remain in the upper world. This must not be allowed. They must be made to descend again among the prisoners in the den and partake of their labors and honors, whether they are worth having or not. And Glaucon says, But is not this unjust? He says, ought we to give them a worse life when they might have a better? And Socrates states, you have again forgotten, my friend. I said the intention of the legislator, who did not aim at many at making any one class in the state happy above the rest. The happiness was to be in the whole state, and he held the citizens together by persuasion and necessity, making them benefactors of the state, and therefore benefactors of one another. To this end he created them, not to please themselves, but to be his instruments in binding up the state. And then he states, observe, Glouton, that there will be no just injustice in compelling our philosophers to have a care and providence of others. We shall explain to them that in other states, men of their class are not obliged to share in the toils of politics. And this is reasonable, for they grow up at their own sweet will, and the government would rather not have them. Being self-taught, they cannot be expected to show any gratitude for a culture which they have never received. But we have brought you into the world to be rulers of the hive, kings of yourselves and of the other citizens, and have educated you far better and more perfectly than they have been educated, and you are better able to share in a double duty. Wherefore each of you, when his turn comes, must go down to the general underground abode and get the habit of seeing in the dark. And when you have acquired the habit, you will see 10,000 times better than the inhabitants of the den, and you will know what the several images are and what they represent, because you will have seen the beautiful and just and good in their truth. And thus our state, which is also yours, will be a reality and not a dream only. It will be administered in a spirit unlike that of other states, in which men fight with one another about shadows only, and are distracted in the struggle for power, which in their eyes is a great good, whereas the truth is of the state in which the rulers are most reluctant to govern is always the best and most quietly governed. The state in which they are most eager is the worst. And will our pupils, when they hear this, refuse to take their turns at the toils of state, when they are allowed to spend the greater part of their time with one another in the heavenly light? Impossible, he answered, for they must for they are just men. And the commands which we impose upon them are just. There can be no doubt that every one of them can take an office as a stern necessity, not after the fashion of our present rules of state. Yes, my friend, I said, and theirs lies, and there lies the point. You must contrive for your future rulers another and a better life than that of a ruler, and then you may have a well-ordered state. For only in the state which offers this will they rule who are truly rich, not in silver and gold, but in virtue and wisdom, which are the true blessings of life. Whereas if they go to the administration of public affairs, poor and hungering after their own private advantage, thinking that hence they are to snatch the chief good, order there can never be, for they will be fighting about office, and the civil and domestic broils, which thus arise will be the ruin of the rulers themselves and the whole state. You see, this is exactly what's ruining our state now, what's ruining the United States. These petty politicians, people who are, hungering after their own private advantage, thinking that hence they will snatch the chief good. An order there can never be, for they will be fighting about office, and the civil and domestic broils which thus arise will be the ruin of the rulers themselves and of the whole state. And that's exactly what's going on now. Because we don't have the integrity in our government, we don't have the integrity in our politicians, and in our society, to appoint or elect these good men, good women, these good, rulers, administrators. And the only life which looks down upon the life of political ambition is that of true philosophy. Do you know of any other? Englogna said, indeed I do not. Socrates says, and those who govern ought to be lovers of the task, for if they are, there will be rival lovers, and they will fight. And who then are those whom we shall compel to be guardians? Surely they will be the men who are the wisest about affairs of state, and by whom the state is best administered, and who at the same time have other honors and a better life than that of politics. They are the men, and I choose them, he replied. I will choose them. And now shall we consider in what way such guardians will be produced, and how they are to be brought in from darkness to light, as some are said to have ascended from the world below to the gods. The process, I said, is not the turning over of an oyster shell, but the turning round of a soul passing from a day, which is little better than night, to the true day of being, that is, the ascent from below, which we affirm to be true philosophy. For those of you who might have just joined me, I'm reading Plato's Republic, Book 7, the analogy of the cave, and I'm almost done, and I'm not almost done, there's still quite a bit left, but please bear with me, because I'll just follow, or you can go back, you can check out the archives after the program, and you get the whole gist of what this is. And it's a lesson of today's politics and today's position, written 3,000 years ago. And the same thing holds true today. But Socrates explains how it can be, how we can have an ideal state as opposed to this wretched one that we have today. The process, I said, is not the turning over of the oyster. Oh, I just read that. And should we not inquire what sort of knowledge has the power of effecting such a change? What sort of knowledge is there that which would draw the soul from becoming to being? And another consideration has just occurred to me. You will remember that our young men are to be warrior athletes. Then this new kind of knowledge must have an additional quality: usefulness in war. There were two parts in our former scheme of education, were there not? There was a gymnastic which presided over the growth and decay of the body, and may therefore be regarded as having to do with generation and corruption. Then there is not the knowledge which we are seeking to discover. No. But what do you say of music, which also entered a certain extent into our former scheme? Music, he said, as you will remember, was the counterpart of gymnastic, and trained the guardians of the influences of habit by harmony, making them harmonious, by rhythm, rhythmical, but not giving them science, and the words, whether fabulous or possibly true, had kindred elements of rhythm and harmony in them. But in music, there was nothing which tended knowledge is there, my dear Glaucon, which is of the desired nature, since all the useful arts were reckoned mean by us? Undoubtedly, and yet by music and gymnastic are excluded, the arts are also excluded. What remains? Well, I said, there may be nothing left of our special subjects, and then we shall have to take something which is not special, but of universal application. Something which all arts and sciences and intelligence use in common, and which every one first has to learn among the elements of education. A little matter of distinguishing 1, 2, and 3, in a word, number and calculation, do not all arts and sciences necessarily partake of them? Then the art of war partakes of them. Then Palamedes, whenever he appears in tragedy, approves Agamemnon, ridiculously unfit to be a general. Did you never remark how he declares that he had invented number, and had numbered the ships and set in array the ranks of the army at Troy, which implies that they had never been numbered before, and Agamemnon must be supposedly literally to have been incapable of counting his own fleet? How could he, if he was ignorant of number? And if that is true, what sort of general must he have been? I should say a very strange one, if this was as you say. And can we deny that a warrior should have a knowledge of arithmetic? Certainly he should, if he is to have the smallest understanding of military tactics, or indeed, I should rather say, if he is to be a man at all. I should like to know whether you have the same notion which I have of this study. It appears to me that a study of the kind we are seeking, and which leads naturally to reflection, but never to have been rightly used for the true use of it, is simply to draw the soul down towards being. I will try, I said, in a wish you would share the inquiry with me, and say yes or no when I attempt to distinguish in my own mind what branches of knowledge have the attracting power, in order that we may have clearer proof that arithmetic is, as I suspect, one of them. And this goes quite a bit onwards, and it's rather lengthy, and I don't think I'll be able to cover it all tonight. But I would reply... I would advise you to check it out. You know, go to just Google. It's available on the internet. I'm reading it from the internet, actually. You can just Google up Plato's Republic, Book 7. And it'll bring you there. I guess what I wanted to talk about tonight, rather than go through the whole text, which is, like I said, another half hour or more of reading, I think I've brought you enough so that you understand that what this is about, in that civilizations must strive to understand. The elite must strive to understand the masses better. Because there are elite, there are better educated, better financed, better physically and mentally and whatnot. But they must have patience and compassion with those less fortunate than they are, less seen. back were imprisoned by their own fears and by their own ignorance, you know. And somehow it's so hard to have patience. I lose patience constantly with people like this, and I fear that because of that, I lose part of my own humanity. I say that in the sense that we are all connected to each other as human beings, as an as a conscious entity, right? And as a cosmic entity, the human race is connected by its similarities, and we are separated by our differences. But our differences are simply obtained by our degrees of enlightenment, our degrees of education, our degrees of experiences. How can a man explain, how can anyone who's been in who's been to the moon explain what it's like to be on the moon? You know, so it's no different than a man who, or one child, you know, who exists on a higher plane of thought, who exists on a higher level of reality, if you will. How does he explain this to someone who is bound in a cave and can't move his head and has been and only believes in shadows and what he hears and, you know, is incapable of making rational decisions because of his confines? And those confines are our own making, in essence, but some are not as well. I mean, others are, I mean, how can a poor wretch soul in the Sudan, starving, you know, miserable wretch, should life, being chased and hunted, his family being hunted down, and, you know, he having to exile and starving and, I mean, thirst, and, you know, losing everything, his home, his jobs, his ability to make a living, and being at the mercy of a refugee camp, you know. How can anybody in a position like mine, or a position like most American, middle-class Americans, if you will, or whatever, and above, able to identify with some poor wretch like that, some horrible situation like that? How do you put your mind into that? How do you accept that? It's almost impossible to. It's much easier to deny that it exists, or to ignore it, or to gain together, you know, in a cult or in a group and say, oh, they must be, you know, they all deserve to die because they're so ignorant and they're so blind and they're so foolish and they're so whatever. And yes, they are, but they don't deserve to die. They have the right to exist just as we do. It's just that in my life, as in others, I mean, and I'm not saying I'm a special, I'm just saying that my life is much better than the poor wretch that is living in squalor and on a desert under a wind-battered tent, you know, eating sand and, you know, living without hope, or only living with hope, you know, of a better future and seeing his wife and children starving before him. Wife being raped and him being beaten because he's a different tribe, or, you know, it's jeez, you know, it's just unbelievable. The horrors that some people face. Or think of the poor Haitian who just, you know, went through this earthquake that shattered their lives, you know, destroyed their country, and living in a tent for the last year, you know, trying to get employment, trying to get food, trying to get, you know, trying to understand what's happened and why God has cursed him, or, you know, why the universe has forsaken them. Like, that to me would be such a frightening concept of, you know, to have to deal with, and one that I would do anything, you know, to free myself of, whatever it is, you know. But to the poor, gentle soul who is incapable of fighting because their body is broken, or they suffer from a massive disease, and they're just barely staying alive. I don't know how to help somebody like that. I don't have the money and the ability to run over there. And if once you do, you see millions of these people, and you can only do, not, you can't do anything other than, I don't know, because the onslaught of humanity, of the onslaught of the pain and suffering of humanity is overwhelming. And, you know, you can only imagine it, but to be there, and to be there as a doctor, or as a worker, social worker, as a human outreach person, I can't even imagine what kind of devotion, commitment, compassion these people have. And yet, at the same time, let's look at the other spectrum, at the other side of the spectrum, and look at the people who are doing this to these poor people, people who are making these people suffer, these people who are, you know, in government because they are there for their own personal aggrandizement, their own personal enrichment, if you will. Damn the people. I got here through deceit and through lies, and I kissed my way up the corporate ladder, or I kissed my way up the, you know, government, and I'm here now. And damn anybody who tries to knock me out. I'll lie, cheat, and steal, and do whatever I have to do to stay in power. And that's what you're dealing with there. So you're dealing with that psychopathic, sociopathic mindset, which is what's creating this horrid government and the horrid governments that we have. And at the same time, you have to confront the millions and millions and millions of Americans, in this case, talking about, who are suffering, desperately suffering. One in five children are malnourished in this country. It's hard to believe, especially when you see the obesity and all this kind of stuff. But the obesity is the same as, you know, you would think it is, but it's food that's not able to be processed. It's not able to metabolize because it's poor quality food, and the body has to store it because it can't get rid of it. It's full of GMOs and pesticides and sugars and everything, all right? And just horrible nutrition. And it's no different than the child who's 100 pounds overweight to the child who's barely alive is of no nourishment. They're both dying from malnutrition. I'm not truly capable of discerning my own feelings regarding the worldwide suffering, malnourishment, malnutrition, and wars and plagues and so on. It's just beyond me, because I don't live there. I don't live in that. I read about it. I see it on television. I may know somebody who has a sickness, but they're not malnourished, you know. And I'm fortunate because I live in the United States. I'm fortunate because I live where I do in the United States. I'm fortunate because I have employment. I'm fortunate because I am able to see a future, a better future, a brighter future for myself and those I love and those and for the world. And because of that, and because I've escaped the cave, I'm not in the cave, you know. What they're saying is people that have escaped, people who know what the world is like, know what the next level is, know what enlightenment is, know what education is, know what earning a decent living is, or knowing what owning a home is like, and knowing what all the pleasures, the material pleasures that you have in life, knowing that and being able to then share that knowledge that you have with somebody who can't even, who has the has nothing, then that's our jobs, I guess. That's our responsibility, is to try to educate people to the light, bring them out, release them from their chains, release them from the darkness. And we can't do that by condemning them, by ridiculing them, by, I've been as guilty as the next guy over this, because, you know, because it's so difficult to restrain your anger at a dog who's coming at you, you know, or somebody who's attacking you, you know, somebody, you know, a foolish dog attacking you. What do you do with that dog? You strike it? Yeah, you have to strike it to defend yourself. The rabid dog will come at you. So it's no different than somebody who is brainwashed and is a rabid right winger, you know, or a rabid liberal, or a rabid hard-headed, impossible to, you know, they see things one way and that's the only way. They have no compassion for people who don't see it any other way. Bullies, people who are bent on getting their way, even if it's the wrong way, but they can do it because they can intimidate you and beat you, you know, up. They can call you stupid. They can, because you don't know any better. Those of us who do know better can go after people like that and put them in their place and not take the insults, but because we stand up. But we have to protect those who can't stand up, those who are still shut in the caves, those who are bound down there to, for no reason of their own other than they were born there, you know. And they'll die there unless they're freed, or at least they're shown light, and then they can choose. But to choose the light or darkness, That's their choice. But they, at least they have to be free in order to do that, free of shackles and chains in order to do that. And that's the only thing that education does for people, is allows them to think, chosen the ways to think, and the endless possibilities of how to think, or what to think of, but directed by the intellect, directed by compassion, directed by hope, directed by love, directed by cosmic awareness. And all who understand what I'm talking about tonight, or all who understand that other dimension of that, of existence, that other reality, whatever it is of yours, if it's better than somebody else's, then it's a wonderment. It's a gift. It's a it's derived from experience and education. The more experience and education that you have, the better you are at analyzing ways for you to achieve a greater life and to avoid the pitfalls and to avoid the horrors of a bad life, starvation and illness and wars and murder and mayhem. You don't need that in your life. You don't want that in your life. So you find ways to avoid that. Others can't avoid it. They don't know how to avoid it. They don't know how. And so they dive right into it and they're part of it. They join the gangs and they become killers and robbers and murderers and, you name it. And they embrace the dark side of man, lower vibrational levels, the darkness, instead of seeking the light. Because all they see are the shadows where they are. All they see are the illusions. All they see are materialism and the need to this or that or have or not have or whatever it may be. But they don't see through the illusion and rise to the highest levels of existence. And that, folks, is where we are. That's where we're supposed to be going. We're supposed to be in this evolutionary cycle, the end of this evolutionary period where we become enlightened. So just as those who were stuck in a cave and released, they're going through a period of transition. Just like we're going through a period of transition. As we enlighten, as we become aware, we realize that those who are not will ridicule us. They will laugh at us. They will laugh at our thoughts, laugh at our at what we do and say. But it doesn't matter because we're right, and we know we're right, so we continue to do it. They laugh at the Occupy Wall Street people, conservatives do, those in the 1%. But I don't believe that the 1% are laughing. I speak to them tonight. They have to come out of their lives and down to the street level and see what their indifference, the human, to the rest of humanity, is doing. They understand how to make all the money in the world, because they do. But in their acquisition of all the money in the world, it depletes it creates the inequity. All the others who aren't geniuses, who aren't Jobs or Gates or Buffett or wherever. It at least provides for them a reasonable livelihood, one of self-respect, of productivity, of health and longevity, in a simple and happy state where they can provide for their children and their human race continues. And these are the essential elements of humanity. And those who hoard and those who, have no idea because they're so obsessed with their greed. They have no idea what they're causing, what pain and suffering they're causing by their greed, by their illegal actions, by their lobbying, by their owning governments, by their doing stuff. They're saying, well, we have the right to do it. You don't. You have not the right to do it. That's what these protests are all about. You do not have the right to steal from us. You do not have the right to kill us. You do not have the right to send us to wars. You do not have the right to lie and cheat and steal to us. Because we are as you, human beings. We are you. If you cast us off, and you cast off your own soul, by doing that, you become dead. Dead to the world. Dead to those around you. And above all, dead to yourself. So, we must all come out of the cave. Start seeing the light. Start seeing the reality as it is. And those of us who have come out of the caves and are out of the caves and have seen the light, seen enlightenment, had a wonderful life, must go back down and tell people, or try to help people, try to educate people, try to bring them out of the darkness. And if the 1% would be willing to do that, show everyone how it's done, rather than to hoard them and everything in secrecy, then it would be a wonderful world, and every wealth would be everywhere. There would be no starving people. There would be no injustices. There would be no police. There would be no need for anything like this, because everyone would have enough money. Everybody would be doing what they do best, and everybody would be happy in that stage, in that state of being. And that, folks, is what is about to happen. In the next few weeks, I'll be having George Dixon on next Friday and the Friday after, as we enter the end time. October 28th, 2011 is the Mayan calendar, time of awakening, time and time, but yet time of a human awakening. And next week, we will be having a tribute to a gentleman named Al Bielik, who was on the Philadelphia experiment. It was he just passed away. He was about 90 years old, and we interviewed him several years ago. But we'll be having a tribute to him with George Dixon and hopefully Peter Moon and Preston Nichols, all people who knew him personally, knew Al Bielik. And it'll be next week. And so I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight. I hope you enjoyed the show.